Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. One of the greatest failures of American policy related to the long occupation of Afghanistan has been the way the nation's broken immigration system has left thousands of Afghans who ought to be on the path to obtaining refuge in this country in a dangerous state of limbo. As retired U.S. Marine, Afghanistan veteran, and North Carolina-based writer Worth Parker explained to me in a recent conversation, people who worked beside Americans and literally put their lives on the line to aid them could soon face deportation and even death at the hands of the Taliban without congressional action to pass a bipartisan bill known as the Afghan Adjustment Act. Fortunately, as he also told me, there's still time for the current Congress to act before year's end. Well, Worth Parker, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
So a lot of the year you spent in Afghanistan was in close contact with members of the Afghan National Security Forces, Afghan civil interpreters. Indeed, it helped give rise to a book you co-wrote with an Afghan interpreter and a fellow Marine named Thomas Schuneman, is it?
Schuneman is the Marine and Zainullah Zaki is the Afghan.
Right. And the book Always Faithful, a story of war in Afghanistan, the fall of Kabul, and the unshakable bond between a Marine and an interpreter. It's an important book for people to read. Tell us some of the story and about your time in country in Afghanistan.
Sure. I spent half a year in 2010. My daughter was actually born while I was overseas. And then again in 2013 and 14 with two separate special operations task forces working on the staffs of those two organizations. And so both for various reasons worked hand in hand with both the Afghan government and the Afghan National Security Forces. So I had a fair bit of exposure to largely the special operations components of the Afghan Army and Air Force to a lesser extent.
And who are these people? Who are these, I presume, mostly men with whom you served and who were serving the Afghan government at the time?
I mean, it certainly was mostly men, but there were absolutely women serving in those units as we worked towards supporting the Afghans in some effort towards a level of democratization. Women did move to the fore relative to where they had been before, certainly relative to where they were under the Taliban then and now. But yes, again, largely men. And so they were folks that wanted to see their nation move forward on the international scene. They wanted to help their nation become more of what they believed it could be. I had one high-ranking Afghan colonel in the intelligence service say to me, you know, I wish you would stay here forever. I wish we could be Germany. I wish we could be Japan. Because when you leave, the streets are going to run red with blood. And that was 11 years before we left. So I don't know that, you know, necessarily that may have been a little hyperbolic, but not entirely.
Well, I take it that when the U.S. ended its presence in the country, a lot of those people with whom you had worked or who had worked with the U.S. in general were put in an incredibly difficult situation, I assume life-threatening in many instances.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, if you read the book, you'll read Zainullah Zaki, goes by Zach here in America because we anglicize everything. Zach was getting death threats via phone, text, folks leaving a hand grenade on the gate to his home. He knew he had to get out of the country. And the thing that I kind of would stress to folks, he didn't want to leave Afghanistan. You know, this wasn't like, oh, I have my golden ticket to America. He wanted to stay in his country that he loved the way that I love the southeastern United States. I grew up in Georgia. I live in North Carolina. This is my part of the world. Eastern Afghanistan, Kunar province was his part of the world. And he really wanted to stay and make it better, until that was made manifestly impossible by people who said, we're going to kill you if you try and stay here and make this better.
We're talking with North Carolina-based writer and former U.S. Marine Worth Parker, who spent 27 years of his life in uniform service, and he spent more than a year of that time in Afghanistan. So what happened to these people? I mean, you talked about they were threatened with violence. I take it a lot of people tried to get out. Probably some successfully got out of the country, maybe went to other countries. A lot of folks wanted to come to the U.S., but obviously there are some issues with our crazy immigration law that's pretty convoluted that's making that very difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think convoluted is generous. I say that after much consideration. In 2013 and 14, I was serving as the plans, policy, and strategy officer for the organization I was assigned to. And we were waiting then to be told what it was going to look like. You know, President Obama wanted to get out of Afghanistan. President Biden had a very clear, then Vice President Biden had a very clear idea of what he thought the right answer would be. And we were waiting for it then. And so 7 years later, we're executing. Now, the first question I have is, how was it so shambolic if we knew 8 years prior that this was a thing we're going to do? And I frankly don't ascribe that to either of the parties. I ascribe that to 20 years of convoluted and confused policy on Afghanistan. But in 2009, if I remember correctly, the Congress voted for the special immigrant visa program. Implementation of that, which was supposed to help Iraqis and Afghans who were directly supporting the U.S. mission in those countries get a visa, was so poorly implemented that by 2014, the Congress had said, we will have an annual report that tells us, State Department, what you have done in furtherance of this legislation. The number of people who had immigrated under the SIV process at that point was in the hundreds. There were 50,000 who had worked directly in support of the United States mission or directly in support of the U.S. government in those countries. And of course, lots of them wanted to come here for a host of reasons. So, I mean, these people to me, they're you and me. I love America. Why wouldn't you want to come to America? But honestly, I wouldn't leave my home. It would take a death threat to get me out of Georgia or North Carolina. And even then, maybe not. So I understand the motivations of these folks. You know, this is not, oh, there's a little American and everybody waiting to come out. There are Afghans who wish they were still in Afghanistan who can't be there anymore. We made promises to them. And then our implementation of those promises, it doesn't even rise to the level of ham-fisted. And we made such a mess out of it that we're making a mess out of people's lives and people are dying as a result of it.
Is there a way that lay people could even understand what's wrong with this SIV program, how it's being so poorly implemented and why, you know, so few people got in, have gotten into the country when there are obviously tens of thousands who need it and deserve it? Is it just the way it's drafted? Is it the way the bureaucracy has implemented it? Do you have any, is there a way to explain what's going on?
The drafting's pretty clear. I've got a law degree, but I don't think you need that to read it. The implementation, however, has been poor at best. Now, in defense of the folks who are working to implement these programs, who I feel like I know. I was in D.C. for 3 years at the Pentagon. I've been inside the machine for a lot of years. These are good people. These are good people trying to do good things. But our bureaucracy is pretty Byzantine anyway. And I don't say that like, you know, I can't believe D.C. It's just a fact. And the requirement is 12 continuous months in employ of the U.S. government or a company directly engaged in the furtherance of U.S. policy. And you've got to be able to document that 12 months. And then after you've documented that 12 months, you've got to get approval either from the first general in your chain of command, if you're working for the military side, or a high-ranking civilian equivalent, if you weren't. And then you've got to get what's called chief of mission approval. And this is just for the SIV process. This is a discrete focus, ignoring people like the Afghan commandos or the Afghan special mission units who fought in line with us and who have no special claim to come here, despite probably being higher on a death list than a lot of folks. Anyway, pardon that tangent. The SIV process is largely for the interpreters. And so if they're able to demonstrate 12 months, then they're good. But if there's any weirdness in their package, which oddly enough, when you translate from Dari or Pashto over to English, or you're doing things under duress, or you're doing things between an Islamic calendar and an American or an English calendar, things get weird. And there's zero tolerance for the weirdness, which is why I think the Afghan Adjustment Act is going to be so important.
So let's talk about that. There is a bipartisan bill sitting in Congress. It's been there for a while that would cut through some of this crazy bureaucracy and maybe cut through some of the BS and allow people actually to save their lives. It's called the Afghan Adjustment Act. Can you tell us any more about it and why it hasn't already passed?
I will tell you that it is a bicameral piece of legislation with support on both sides of the aisle. There certainly are some members of the House and Senate who have reservations, largely revolving around security. Now, in the middle of the Afghan evacuation in Kabul in 2021, I was working with a host of other military and intelligence folks, and then just a lot of good civilians to try and get people with whom we had worked for 20 years out of the country. And one of my aunts, who I absolutely adore, who is a deeply evangelical woman in a small town in Georgia, called me and said to me, honey, do we need to think about safety here? And I said to her, absolutely, we need to think about safety. I've been in the security business for 20 years, 27 years. I want to know who's coming in and out of the country. However, there's two things at work here. I said, number one, there's Jesus's parable of the stranger. I mean, this was in the middle of emergency, but you do unto others, you treat the stranger as you would want to be treated. Secondly, there's the issue of within the AAA, the Afghan Adjustment Act, they're getting revetted. So this will be a third, even more strenuous, not under duress or extremists kind of vetting that will answer those problems. And the people that don't meet that standard will have to go home. And that's going to be a significant emotional event for a whole lot of people. But I will tell you that on Friday, Zainul Izaki, the guy who risked his life multiple times to save Marines, got denied his special immigrant visa for the second time. There is no appeal for a second unless you just want to start the entire process again and introduce new information as part of that process. So amazing. The Afghan Adjustment Act is the hope on which I pin his future and that of his wife and that of his now four children, one of whom was born here and who is an American citizen. Because in the midst of the evacuation, Tom Schumann was talking to Zach and said, you know, brother, I love you. I'm doing the best that I can here, but if things were looking dark, you know, what will happen if we can't get you out? What will you do? He said, we'll die. And he just said it like, no guilt to you. Thank you for trying. Yeah. You've done the best that you can, but we'll just go back to Kunar and be killed. And that's something Americans don't get. I'm sorry, but we just don't. We don't face that binary.
It's a remarkable state of affairs. And it's, I must say, I find it somewhat shocking that for such an appealing set of circumstances, it's hard to imagine that, and with a bipartisan bill in both the House and the Senate, it seems just remarkable that it hasn't proceeded at this point.
A lot of it will, as I say, largely turn on those congresspersons and senators who are, it's not recalcitrant, I don't think, but perhaps have some concerns. Again, largely revolving around security, and that's a reflection of their constituency by and large. But to me, as I say, this is an American issue. You know, America's been called the last best hope. America's been called the shining city on the hill. If we're that thing, and if we're truly those people, then to me, one, we are willing to accept some risk in the interest of what's right. And that is a thing that I fear we've lost sight of. I think that I am concerned that we're a nation that is becoming consumed by and overcome by fear. And that has never been an American characteristic, just the opposite. You don't put people on the moon. You don't throw off the yoke of a foreign monarchy when you're scared. And so, one, I'm not scared because I served with these people and I know who they are and I welcome them here. I visited Zach up at Fort Pickett in Virginia when they were at the resettlement centers living in barracks that were built in the 40s and 50s with families stacked on families. And when I talked to those men there in a lot of ways, I felt more alignment to them than a lot of the American men with whom I hang out, because less than 1% of this nation served in our 20-year war, whereas those gentlemen served in some of the most elite and most combat-focused unit in the Afghan formations, which really meant in the American formation. So it was like talking to my people. And I guess I just ask the American folks who listen to this and hear this to hear me say, you know, I'm one of you. They're one of us. One of my very dearest friends flew into Kabul. He's a retired Army Ranger who did 15 deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, 54 total months in combat. And Jake got on an airplane and he flew to Kabul, got off the plane and stayed to help, just as the Rangers say, sua sponte, of their own accord. And he emailed me from the middle of this thing. And he's like, these people are going to be our amazing future Americans. And he's a tough guy. You know, yeah. He's not a guy who's, please pardon the expression, because I'm married to one, but he's not a big bleeding heart liberal.
I gotcha.
He's a person who recognizes the import of humanity. And I really believe that's what the Afghan Adjustment Act comes down to. It's our American ability to recognize the inherent humanity in people.
And I presume it wouldn't hurt matters if listeners decided to write a letter or an email or call the offices of Senators Burr and Tillis and maybe our members of Congress and remind them of these facts.
I think that is absolutely critical. I think, frankly, regardless of what your opinion is on the Afghan Adjustment Act, invigorate yourself as an American and make that opinion known. Obviously, I prefer if it's in support of the act, and I think it should be. I think it's a moral choice. Yes, make your voice heard. Those people work for us. Make them work for us and do the thing that is right.
Worth Parker is a North Carolina-based writer and former U.S. Marine who devoted 27 years of his life to uniform service. He spent more than a year on the ground in Afghanistan. Worth, thank you for your service to our country, both during your term, your service in the Marines and afterwards, and the work you're doing now. It's important stuff. We really appreciate it. Please take care and stay well.
Well, thank you, and thank you for helping out.
Coming up next, a special two-part conversation with retiring North Carolina Congressman David Price. Don't go away.